everybody please get a seat so we can continue with the rest of the meeting? Okay, thank you. Our able crew of election tellers are off to do the counting. If we could get a seat, please.
I'm sorry. It's not here to record motion.
All right, everybody get a seat, please. First order of business is to call for the reading of the minutes of the last association meeting. Chair would entertain a motion to dispense with those that reading.
I shall move.
Second? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign?
Opposed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Jack. I'd like now to shift into a different portion of the meeting for just a little bit while our tellers are going to be back at work. I'd like to shift into the town hall portion of the meeting. This is a portion. How many first-time attendees do I have here? Excellent. Okay. Here's the deal, right? Robert's rules, motions, seconds, all that stuff, very confusing stuff, okay? I've been doing that stuff for a while. We're going to have a conversation, hopefully. And there aren't any rules other than the following simple ones. The NAR president has a very bad input system. It's like USB 1.1 or lower, okay? Can only one person talking at a time, please? Second, if you want to speak, raise your hand. I'll get around to you eventually. When you stand up or when you announce yourself, we need to know who you are and where you're from, because everybody here doesn't really know everybody here, okay? So be helpful. You know, if we could adhere to those simple rules, that would make things flow a lot simpler. So those are the only rules. Second thing is that anything's open game. It works better if it's a conversation. I could talk to you for many, many hours about what's going on in the NAR, but it's better for you to tell me what you want to hear in terms of what's going on in the NAR and where things are. So if you drive this portion of the meeting, it will be far more productive for you and for me. Are there any immediate questions on people's minds, having set that stage? Yes, sir.
Not a rocket museum.
I'm sorry. Please tell us who you are and where you're from.
I'm Ron Daniels, also known as the Rocket Doctor. Originally from New Jersey a month ago, now I'm in South Carolina. I've been trying to pursue a model rocket museum. I contacted the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
The first price they gave me was $25,000. Then they upped the ante, they wanted $50,000. I says, I don't think there's anybody around that could put up $25,000, let alone $50,000. My thought is, we've made it to 50 years now. There's a lot of information out there in private collections and in the general public. This all needs to be preserved and shown to more people, to get more people into the NAR, get more people into the hobby. My second thought was, why not pursue Space Camp in Huntsville? They have the kids coming there, they're doing rocketry there, and I'm sure there's enough NASA buildings there that could be used for that. I think we need a museum. I know Bill Stein has one out on the West Coast. I think we need one to preserve the hobby for future generations to benefit from it. And I'd just like everybody's thought on that.
Yes, sir.
Bob Sanford, San Diego, California. I think what Kim was talking about, there was a discussion on one of the forums about preservation of the hobby, and a contact was made with the Smithsonian about, you know, having a display area in one of the museums, and they came back with, well, you basically have to pay for it. And they started quoting prices for the construction of a display for the museum concerning model rocketry specifically, or hobby rocketry in whatever form it is. We were just curious, since it wasn't getting a lot of press and they didn't seem to have a whole lot of interest in pursuing it any further, if perhaps the NAR may want to look at a
in cooperation with other organizations or manufacturers, establishment of a display, perhaps with rotating or changing sections of the display in a small cube area, freestanding perhaps, further pursue it with the Smithsonian, and perhaps raise the funds in some way to do this project.
Okay. Any other comments?
Jim Filler, Frederick, Maryland. As my recollection serves, about 1976, the National Air and Space Museum opened on the National Mall. Being a young, avid rocketeer at the time, I had such the opportunity to visit the museum. There was a model rocket display at the National Air and Space Museum. I remember seeing some quite historic artifacts that I thought at the time, but I don't ever know what happened to it, to be honest with you. I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay, you're there.
Any other comments?
Okay. I'd just like to follow up on that. I'm trying to find out just how many rockets that the Smithsonian has. They don't have the catalog. I've sent emails to Matt Craddock and a few other people, David James from the Smithsonian. They have no clue what they have, where it's being stored, or anything like that. So, from what I understand, they're supposed to have between 300 and 400 models there, but they have no clue what they actually have.
Yeah, it's where the archive is coming in.
Okay. Other comments?
Bunny, just on the Mike Coleman, Orlando, Florida. Just on that, and I mean, I know that we're not real fond of the AMA, but doesn't the AMA have a museum?
I would take exception to the fact that we're not fond of the AMA.
I mean,
okay.
Don't take that. But anyways, I mean, I don't know whether that might be an easy and perhaps a logical place to start to see if they can provide some space zones.
Okay, other comments?
Actually,
who are you? Where are you from, sir?
Thank you. Sorry. Jack Haggerty. Oh, I got to stand up. Jack Haggerty from the far left coast, almost into the ocean from California. I'm not quite sure I understand the purpose here other than gathering old stuff, because the way Ken was talking, was it as a research library? You said you wanted to gather all of the information together in one place?
To preserve the hobby for others. Basically a museum of model rocketry, where you can go and see the progression of the hobby and have it preserved so it's not just
lost.
On the way. Yeah.
Okay. I thought maybe it was a research lark that way.
Hi, Jonathan Raines, Silver Spring, Maryland. A couple things. When the Air Space Museum opened up, Harry's collection was there. It was in the satellite gallery for a number of years. And it was taken away after a while. And then AMA got a big cube. And then the NAR got a big cube. Or rocketry got a big cube. Like, for instance, John Langford donated Bob Ethan's and John Langford's javelin. And that was in there. Ed Pearson put a lot of stuff there. Because, you know, I lived outside of Washington. And the fact is that tens of thousands of people or millions of people go through the most popular museum in Washington. And, you know, rocketry is just a speck. Both the model airplane cube and the rocket cube, no matter how exciting you could make it, it really wasn't an attraction. And the fact is that if you really want to show the history of the hobby and put something out there for literally millions of people to see, I would suggest putting together an online collection of photographs and artifacts and documents, because you know I personally work for one of the largest publishing companies in Washington, actually one of the largest publishers in the country, and we've gone from physical medium and CDs to electronics. And if you really want to put it out there for people to see, you know, what we've done and where we're going, I think the best thing would be to think of putting together some sort of electronic presence. And people will find it. There's I'm not dissing museums, I'm not dissing displays, but if you really want to put the history out there that people can really touch it, I would suggest to do it in electronics. Electrons, and think of it in that perspective.
There was a comment from this side.
Tom Pastrick, Des Plaines, Illinois. I think John Raines said it better for me. In the early days, G. Harry Stein at one point donated like one of every motor, one of every kit, one of every plastic kit that could be modified to the Smithsonian. It's my understanding Smithsonian now has everything on computer. It's something over 6 million items. It's pretty hard to explain them all. The suggestion is to have a museum. Yes, it'd be a great idea to have a museum. But there is so much in Motorocracy that could be displayed. We'd need a pretty large building. We couldn't do it in this room. You just way too much of it. But it is a great idea to have a museum because where we are now are a result of history. Everything that's going on in the past has led us to where we are now.
Okay, let me make a few comments since Art Nestor's timing is virtually perfect here. How many of you are aware that NAR has a historian now? Well, shame on me, okay? He just walked into the back room. Art, stand up. Art Nestor is the NAR historian, right? We had a request to create that position at our board meeting at the NARCON back in March, and we did. And technically, you know, for those of you who are into organizational management, Art works for George Rocker, the NAR secretary, who's responsible for cataloging records in the archives, if you will, of the association. And Art has gone around and done a lot of work. Art, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about what you've been up to, you know, both before and after your official appointment as NAR historian and what you're trying to do. Your choice. Come on up if you want. It's not quite open mic, but, you know, for you. Since you're part of the management, come on up.
So if you didn't know that there was an NAR historian, that's understandable. It's only been created within, what, about the last 3 months. And, I wasn't prepared to speak, but I'll say a few things. I realize that many of you are far more qualified to be an historian than I am. Many of you have held positions over the years. I pretty much stayed to my corner in southwestern Pennsylvania, and I'm pretty fiercely a Pittsburgh person, and that's pretty much where I stayed. I haven't been involved on a national basis. And so many of you have lived the history that we're trying to record. So I know that many of you are more qualified than I am, but I'll try to do what I can. Basically, I'm collecting information, not artifacts, not Estes Century Company stuff. It's just strictly NAR. Recently, I've been working on trying to complete the entire section roster from number one, which was Mile High section in 1958, up through the current sections. It's probably a little over 700 sections now. Trying to complete that list, I need a lot of help. Right now, I'm digging up a lot of information where it may be so that I can get at it. And I'm not the author or the books or the radio personality, Dr. Knowledge. So if you ask me, you know, who was the ugly one in the good and bad in the ugly section, I can't tell you.
Eli Wallach.
Although I've seen a picture of the good and bad in the ugly section. I can't tell you if Mickey Mouse was a member of the Mickey Mouse section. But trying to dig things up, and actually I'll be doing more since NARM 50 and AOR will be finished. So I'll try and take over from there. There was a flyer in your packet, and you can contact me by email or phone if you have anything you think I might be interested in. I'm not interested in collecting things. I'm not trying to make my basement a museum. I would a lot of times like to see things so I can scan it in and digitize it. Other than that, I don't know what to say right now. But I did collect some things for NARM 50 in the OR, and they may be on the DVD. I don't know yet. I haven't viewed mine. Section roster. I want to talk to John Hockheimer. One thing I would like to do is have a section history request form put in packets sent to newly forming sections. The idea is that if I can collect information on new sections as they form, it's far better than trying to collect it after they've disappeared or they've been around for 10 years. I'd like to collect that information while people are enthusiastic and have photos and the information right there available and recorded as they are created. That's another thing that I'd like to do. And as I said, I'm looking for information. If you can help me, there are some things I've mentioned on the list in the flyer in your packet that I, you know, could help me.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Yes?
Just one other tidbit about existing
collections. Tell us who you are.
George Rocker, Hillsborough, Oregon.
Thank you.
One other tidbit about collections that exist around the country. Some of Harry Stein's stuff is currently on display at the Museum of Flight in Seattle. I've seen it. There's not enough of it there, but it's really good to see. So it's a start. There's a place that is showing the model rocket. That exhibit is supposed to be there for a long time. So...
Okay.
It's a start.
All right. Yes, sir.
Steve Loveliner, Tucson, Arizona. For subjects, you announced a while back.
Okay. Well, let me make some closing comments, if I could, Steve, about the history part of this. Okay. I think those of us who have gathered here understand the value and the need to collect, preserve, and protect the history of the hobby, because if we don't protect it and preserve it, it's going to be lost. So I think protecting it and preserving it is a smart thing for us to do. The method by which we do that is not entirely clear to me, whether or not it's a physical collection, which could be quite immense because the hobby is quite diverse, quite rich, and is 50 years old, and it's a lot of stuff. As I said on Saturday night when I started thinking about what we've done in 50 years, we've done a lot of stuff, you know? It's a lot of physical stuff with rockets and engines and launchers and plans and magazines and newsletters and, oh my God, okay. Preserving it electronically might be something that might be really much easier, much simpler, and much easily distributed and much more conducive to presenting that history to a new generation of rocketeers who did not grow up with mimeographed newsletters. I would encourage people to look in your packet, find the sheet. All right, what color is that sheet?
Yellow.
The yellow sheet in your contestant's packet, and then get in touch with Art. I've known Art for a long time. I've seen him write stuff about rocket history in his local area, so I think he's a better historian than he gives himself credit for. And I think some of you right here may have an idea that he hasn't thought of yet, and you give him that idea, and I bet the collaboration of the two of you together could produce some really interesting stuff. And that's the way that I think maybe we ought to be thinking about doing this. To the extent that the NAR needs to commit more resources to it, either by supporting something at the Smithsonian or the Seattle Museum of Flight where Harry's material is displayed, you know, we need, what I need in order to act on that is a name. Somebody who's in a position of authority in those museums to say to them, "Hi, I'm the president of the NAR. We're interested in preserving our history. Could we have a conversation about that? And what would it really take?" I don't know whether it'll take $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, $250,000. I don't know what the money is, and I don't know what the standards are for different museums. Different museums have different things. Not to say that it isn't valuable, not to say that we shouldn't do it. We need more information. We need to have dialogue with museums that might be interested in doing that if it's going to be a physical display. A virtual display, I think we could do something through Art on our own to try to move that process forward. So I would encourage you at the NARAM to talk to Art and then continue to dialogue with the NAR board about where this might go, particularly now that we've had this tremendous celebration here around the 50th anniversary.
Steve
Loveliner.
Yeah, the question is on the 4-H. It was announced that we have a working relationship with 4-H folks.
Yes.
Looking for more information. Are we supposed to be a full thing where we go to the 4-H people know about the local section, uh-huh, that we're there to serve? Do we have names to go, you know, introduce ourselves to them?
Going to call on Vince Hughley to talk about our 4-H relationship. I don't know whether you want to come up here and use the mic, Vince, or not. Vince has been...
I don't want to get into that that much. Vince Hughley from Huntsville, Alabama. We formed the partnership about a year ago in May, and as we're sitting the past year, getting kind of to know each other on the national level, with 4-H, understanding how their organization works. They do have staff
here in Washington that runs the whole organization, but most of it is volunteers, much like we are. So we are trying to understand how their channel communication works, how they talk to all of their groups, and try to get rocket material offered to them so that they can know who we are, for us to find out who they are. We have links on each other's websites. We've accomplished that in the first year. There was a 4-H article in Sport Rocketry. We have also sent them some information. So we're kind of getting to know each other. We're kind of in a honeymoon period, but we're still trying to get it all down where the grassroots connect, where you have the NAR people in one area working with the 4-H people in the other area. But you can take the initiative now, because this has been set up, that if you know some 4-H people or are looking for some, go ahead and do it as your NAR section. Invite them to your launches. Tell them who you are, because they are hearing it from their management that 4-H is going to be doing more rocketry, and they are strongly encouraged to form TAR teams. We had several TAR teams from 4-H last year. They've been pretty good supporting. We're looking to jump that up. And now we also have a 4-H team that's good launch initiative. So,
hey Vince, talk a little bit about the material that we have distributed.
Okay.
Packets of information.
What we have provided for them, we have the NAR educational CD. We have the DVD that is How to Build a Model Rocket that was... I think sent to the TARP teams.
Yes.
And both
of them. It's a 40-minute video presentation, you know, introductory rocket building stuff for TARP teams who sometimes don't know which way the grain on their fins should run and that sort of thing.
Right. We also have the NAR membership booklet and a page, a couple documents on how to start a rocketry club, how to, you know, what's the first thing you do, how to get formed, what you can do, how you can do contests. Got all this together. And sent it to 4-H headquarters, and their people have been requesting it. They announced it to 4-H to send out to the groups. Different groups have requested those. We're up to about 300 packages that we have sent out all over the country. So, well, we have provided 500. So we have that many going out. So we're getting established. Not everybody in 4-H wants to do rockets. Some of them, you know, still hold on to sheep and goats and rabbits and agriculture.
Not an image we should be painting, Vince. Try cows next time, okay?
They are pushing high tech. You know, 4-H has always been about science, and they have been connected to universities and land grant institutions. It is a massive organization. It is larger than the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts put together. So there's a lot of kids out there. They want their kids to do rocketry. We want their kids to do rocketry, and so that's what we're working on.
We've been doing Ronnie Johnson, Wichita Camp.
Excellent, thank you.
We've been doing 4-H for 15 years in Kansas, and what's the main selling point is that it's cheaper than raising a cow.
I'm writing that down.
Why rockets cheaper than raising a cow?
Okay, so the fuel isn't regulated. Who cares?
That's what the parents will say. This is cheaper. We'll do this.
Yes, sir.
Robert Holloway from Otsego, Michigan, the most adult in last year's NARA, which was held at the Collatorium by we had a little go wrong, which turned out to be more in neighborhood politics than anything else, but we still have that feel for those of you who are concerned and interested in hearing about things going on. But on the permission letter that the man who owns the bill had, it was actually, he could do 4-H activities, and that specific discussion came up with this national 4-H connection, so that was an important part of it. So I think the 4-H connection overall is going to be a good thing.
Any other comments?
I was heavy into 4-H in the early 70s, and
my club, the Wayne Skyhawks in New Jersey, we did a part for the Hobby Industry of America, and there was four segments in that. It was a TV commercial. One of them was on model rocketry. Just recently, within the last 5 years, I made up two prototypes for 4-H rockets. You got the clover leaves for the fins. I have a small one for the kids and a large one for the leaders. And I tried to push that through a Midwestern model rocket company, which I will not name, to get the kids involved in model rocketry to have a model rocket just for them, to get them started. If there's any vendors here that would be interested in doing something like that, I have my two prototypes here, and you can look at them. Maybe that's another approach to it. Have something dedicated just for 4-H'ers where they say, this is our model rocket, we're proud of it, let's do it.
Yes?
Buddy, is there any information that we have received from them to understand what their rocketry program consists of, that in the sections we can tailor what we do to their needs?
Vince, you want to comment on that?
We're working on that. We know that there are rocketry programs within 4-H because one of their elements is that you build a rocket and you take it to the state fair. And you have a regional one, state local fair, county fair, state fair, national fair. So we're trying to get all some of that information is in the 4-H catalog. We're trying to reconcile what they're doing, you know, what their material is, and then also what their real programs are, and try to understand them and integrate them with our programs. So it's being worked, but you know we're still working.
Not there yet.
Yeah. Well, we'll let you know as soon as we get.
Jennifer Archer Pool, Southern Maryland. Steve, what we do in Maryland, they have an aerospace club where they do both RC gliders and rockets. And the aerospace at the national level has some packets, so you might want to put that bug into the 4-H club. So it's an aerospace club. So they have some packets for that. I've seen since they are older. They do have some curriculum for that. So that may be the key word that gets them to think national. It's an aerospace club. That's the one I know of.
Well, again, I judged the 4-H aerospace competition for the Montgomery County Agricultural Fair last year. And it's basically controlling airplanes and rockets. It's like no great chase. You just kind of see what it is. They basically, they are looking for NAR people coming to help judge the fairs. So they want someone to look at the rocket and say, that's a pretty cool looking rocket, and then you have to place them and stuff. So it was an interesting experience for me. Got paid $40 to it too. So first time I really made money in rocketry. So I mean, you're asking like, you know, what do we do? You kind of walk up to the 4-H club and you say, so I'm with the NAR section and how can I help? And that's how I, you know, helped last year at the Ag Fair.
From my perspective, Steve, and others, right, the 4-H is an immense organization, and it's run through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's County Extension Services, so it has arms all over the place. And it seemed to me after the initial discussions and the immediate discussions that followed our memorandum of understanding that this is an organization that tries to centrally push information out to local groups. But those local groups have a lot of autonomy about what they choose to do, and in many cases, how they choose to do it. For this program to succeed for the NAR, I think either or both of two things have to happen. One was, NAR sections tell me that the fastest way they have problems creeping into their clubs is if they don't have a launch site. Well, these are people who do agriculture, farms, you know, places that are open, land that might not be easily accessible. Relationship with National 4-H gives us the potential to secure more launch sites. The other thing they do is they touch over 4 million kids annually. Some of those kids are going to take an extreme interest in cows. Other people are going to take an extreme interest in rockets or airplanes. And we got to be there in order for them to get connected to us. So So in the long run, if we can establish the connectivity between those local groups and local NAR members or sections, then this partnership will succeed. If we're unsuccessful in doing that, then I think the partnership will not work as well as we had hoped. And it will take time to build that relationship, again, because it's an immense organization, you know, pushing things out to a lot of local levels. And so I think we have to give this program a couple of years at a minimum to see whether or not it's going to bear any fruit. Other questions?
Mike Hellman, Orlando, Florida. I just briefly asked Tripp about this, but is there any way that we can some way track or find out the participants that are in TARP, what happens to them after their high school years? Do they go on to an aerospace? Mm-hmm. Do they pursue an aerospace career or not? Especially in the data as it pertains to the young ladies who participate in TARP.
Okay.
It would be good data to have.
I'm laughing because I think you've been set up.
No, I haven't.
Oh, yes, you have. Earlier this year, the NAR went out and secured the services of a web-based survey tool called SurveyMonkey. And we did some surveying of former members, and we did some surveying of people who used to compete and now no longer compete, and we did also a survey of TARP participants. We went to our partners at AIA and said, hey, we have a tool that can let you survey these kids. And we think it would be important for you to see this information. So we surveyed these kids. And we got all kinds of good stuff back from them, where approximately 70%+ of these kids say they're going to go on to pursue a technical, scientific, or engineering career. And they attribute their participation in TARP generally to saying either that has affirmed an initial interest that they had in that field or it's sparking that interest. And we presented those results to the people at AIA, in particular their manager who is responsible for workforce development. The AIA sees this thing as a workforce development tool to try to get more kids involved in aerospace careers. So we presented this year the first solid, tangible evidence that said, yes, you are doing this. Also, they had dug out, like, one of these kids who had participated in the first TARP and is now working with the aerospace company?
Aerojet
General. He went to work for them, pursued his collegiate career, and went to work for Aerojet. And he got up in front of, 700 kids who were there at the TARP finals and said, here's what happened to me. I participated in this contest and went on to pursue an engineering degree, and here's the kind of work that I'm doing now for Aerojet. This is what awaits you if you want to pursue that. So I think we've gotten the message. I have to confess I was a little concerned because the AIA got a new president this year, Marion Blakely, who used to be the head of the FAA, and I didn't know whether or not she would be enthused about a contest that, she didn't know anything about and had any experience with, and I'm thankful and pleased to say that after she got there and she saw what was going on, she got it right away. Well, duh, everybody does when they get the TARP finals. So I think all sorts of good things are happening, and now we're going to be able to track these kids on a much more consistent basis going forward and demonstrate to people that what they want to have happen is indeed happening. And heavens knows, how many people have been to TARP finals? Those of you who haven't, you're missing out on something, man. I tell you, you get there to see these kids, you're gonna see what's really cooking with these kids. It's amazing. And now we have hard data to back that up. So I think that's all headed in a very, very solid direction. I'm very, very pleased about that. Okay. Other questions? Concerned about any NAR committees? Issues? Yes?
Bob Sanford, San Diego, California. Again, Mr. President, I don't know if this is the proper place, any comments on the lawsuit status?
Any comments on the lawsuit status? My favorite subject. Well,
it's our favorite subject, too.
No, the short answer is no, Bob. Last year, at the end of July, we were supposed to have a status hearing. It was canceled the day before. It was due to occur. While I was in Washington, D.C., en route to that conference, they canceled it. And there's been no further movement since then. I have had some discussion with counsel about what to do next. Prior to his death, Joe Egan sent a message to us that I asked him, you know, what realistically are our options, and his answer was, there are no options that would not be dangerous for us to try. So there are, I think, some potential legal options to go to the court and ask them to do something, but Joe at the time was not of a mind to think that that was the right thing to do. There'll be some further discussion post-NARAM, I think, on that subject. We could certainly request a status hearing to find out what, you know, the ATF has been up to given the direction of the court, and to spur them on to do something. But people keep asking me, you know, they say, Bunny, why isn't there a limitation? You know, how many people here have read the rules of civil procedure for federal courts? Okay. Barbara Bundy has, because she used to be an attorney, right? Licensed to practice in federal courts. Her husband has read them too, okay? Her husband has read them and has discovered that there are all kinds of remedies for the courts to tell either the defendants or plaintiffs to do something, but there are no remedies for the plaintiffs or the defendants to tell the court what to do. And while that might seem irritating, in some respects, that seems to be the reasonable thing to do from a, you know, constitutional standpoint. So, you know, we don't have any way to force the court to meet particular dates in order to rule a decision. And at least I knew that going into the litigation, that this is an unbounded process in terms of the time that it might take. Having said that, then, you know, others will decide, you know, how they want to pursue this and what action we might take. But we are waiting for a federal court judge to decide to do one of two things, either issue a ruling from the bench and decide the case with the matter before him, or to call the matter to trial. Those are the two options that are in front of us.
Thank you.
Sure.
Jim Walker from Seattle, Washington. I think I may have read something about this in a magazine, and forgive me if I didn't follow it closely enough, but any thought in the NAR about going to altimeter-based altitude competition as opposed to DIY tracking?
Tom Lyon, where are you?
Tom Lyon was called to Dr. Data's room.
Tom Lyon was called to Dr. Data's room. I believe you can do that now, right? That RCP passed. There was a rule change proposal that said if you want to use altimeters to do your altitude, knock yourself out.
As long as everybody in the contest does it.
Right. Yeah. Got to do it. Can't mix and match. Got to pick a method to do the altitude determination.
And that would be up to the contest director?
I believe so, yes. Other questions?
Frank Bittinger, Houston, Texas. Now that Joe Egan is no longer with us, who's representing the NAR legally?
Okay, who's representing the NAR legally? Joe was a partner in a law firm that he and other people were involved in. The other principal person involved in our case is a guy named Marty Malsh, who for a time was the chief counsel to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. His entire career has been spent in administrative law. He is a very, very sharp administrative lawyer. You know, after he got done working at the NRC, he proceeded to spend his career, you know, suing the Department of Energy with Joe about a lot of other stuff. After Joe's passing, they wanted to go out and find other experienced people to join their firm. Their practice is principally in litigation surrounding nuclear energy issues. People who have paid attention since the beginning of the case may remember that a lot of our legal work initially was done by a man named John Lawrence, whom I remember for two reasons. One, he was always dressed in a bow tie, a very sharp dresser. But the other thing was he wrote a vast majority of the drafts and the final briefs that we filed initially in litigation, and it's some of the best legal writing I've ever seen. And unfortunately, in my professional life, I've had to read a lot of legal documents. He has come and joined the firm that Joe founded and still bears his name. So John Lawrence will be part of our legal team going forward and is very, very familiar with the litigation. So we have two very experienced administrative law attorneys who are handling our case for us. Okay. Any other comments? If there aren't, before I ask the secretary to read the election results, which I assume he has in his hot little hand, I have some personal remarks that I'd like to make to you tonight. I want you to stop, for those of you who can, and think about where you were in the summer of 1994. Where I was the president of the Northern Illinois Rock Tree Association, NAR Section 117. And circumstance had been such that it looked like I was going to be the next NAR president. I was a little concerned about this because there were a set of people who were, for better or for worse, thinking that the administration of Mark Bundick and Pat Miller was not the best thing for the NAR and that there needed to be a change. And so they started what they called an opposition political movement. I went to Muncie, Indiana to see the U.S. team practice for the upcoming World Championships because some of the people who were leaders of that movement were going to be there. And after spending the weekend there, I got in my car to drive back to Chicago and realizing that the political wherewithal they had in order to accomplish that goal was unlikely to deter me, I went back to Chicago pretty sure that I was going to be the next NAR president. So in June, I went to the NIRA meeting with a little bit of a mix of emotions. You know, NIRA had been a longstanding section for me, and I wanted to leave that club. And at the time, before these circumstances had changed, I thought I was getting ready to leave the NAR board. And so I went to the NIRA meeting to explain to my fellow club members that I was going to have to leave them after only a year as president. So after the club business was done and I explained that to them, there were a few seconds of shocked silence, and then my good friend Bob Kaplow went, "You're nuts."
I stand by that statement.
Well, I didn't think I was nuts then, and I certainly don't think that I was nuts now, but people need to understand that I had very good reasons for wanting to lead our organization. The first one was personal. I've told several of you this weekend that the NAR changed the trajectory of my life. And when I was a young NAR member, not experienced, not known, all kinds of people reached out to help me, to teach me about rockets, and to teach me about the NAR. Well, Terry Lee came up to me at NARM 13, stuck his hand out, said, "Hi, my name's Terry Lee. I live in Virginia too. You know, let's stay in touch." And all along the way, people did that for me, over and over and over again. The guys in the MIT Rocket Society had no clue who this skinny kid was and whether or not he could build rockets and what he was all about. They stopped and took time to help me. And that's a story that's repeated over and over and over again. And after a couple of years of that, I felt, well, driven, compelled to repay in some way the kindness that people had shown me. I will never, ever, ever be as good a modeler as many of you are here in the room. And the only way I could think of to repay what I had been shown was to try to get involved administratively. And those people are the reason, one of the reasons, the main reason that I initially started to serve the NAR. The second reason I wanted to do this was professionally based. I am a student of business management, a graduate of the University of Chicago's Business School. And I think MBAs get a bad rap among the technical people who are the vast majority of the population out here. If MBAs are doing their job, they make the job of technicians and software engineers and analysts and scientists easier. When I was a business school student, one of the last courses I took was a course called Business Policy, Business 361. Chicago was not a fan of Harvard's case method, and this was the only course in the entire career that I had in the 2 years I was at the university that was done by the case method. So we would prepare cases and then present them in front of the class. I'm sure it'll be a shock and amazement to people here that the team I was attached to, almost all the presentations I made. One time we got a consumer products case, and we had an executive from Sara Lee Corporation come in to evaluate them. And he systematically destroyed all six business cases that were in front of him. I left class that night thinking, oh my God, we're one of the best business schools in the nation. and the best students were supposed to have figured this out, and nobody got this right. Nobody could please this man. What am I doing here? Did I really learn what I needed? When I got out in the working world, I'm happy to say that I've had a very productive and professional career that I've richly enjoyed, been richly blessed, and I've learned a lot of stuff. But it was very clear to me early in that game that I was not going to be running any Fortune 500 companies. I kept wondering all along the way whether or not I could take what I had learned at the University of Chicago campus and apply it somewhere. Could I figure out the accounting, the finance, the marketing, the business law, the operations, the strategy, the organizational theory and behavior, and make it work? The NAR gave me that opportunity. Somebody else is going to have to look at the stewardship that I've had and figure out whether or not I did it. But for me, those ghosts from Business 361, Business Policy, will no longer haunt my mind. The last reason I wanted to become NAR president was not clear to me at the start, but became more and more clear and ultimately became the most important reason that I did this work. I came to believe that this work was pastoral, that God called me to this work. A very strange idea. We're all technicians. What does this have to do with a faith? It was Barbara who first suggested this to me, and I rejected the idea. But it kept rattling around in my head when I was thinking about doing this. And so finally, in a fit of desperation, I went to see my spiritual advisor, who is not Barbara. It's the Reverend Jeff Doan at Lincoln Park Presbyterian Church. Jeff Doan and I could not be more opposite if we tried. Me, a conservative Republican banker. Him, a liberal Democrat who chose to be a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War and do his work in prisons instead of serving in the Army. Somehow, he and I became fast friends. So I called Jeff up. We had lunch. I explained to him my conundrum. How could it be, thinking that I was going to leave the NAR and go do something else, how could it be that this opportunity was presented to me? And it's a secular organization. How could it be seen as a call of faith? Jeff did what he always does when I ask him questions like this. He stopped, he listened, he contemplated, and he says, listen, if the work that you do makes it better and people are happy and they get to experience life to its fullest and enjoy it, then who is to say it's not a call? So I left that lunch, came to some grudging acceptance of it, and then went on with the journey. And since then, God has tested me, and tried me, and consoled me, and supported me in all kinds of ways. And to be sure, my response to that call is imperfect. I am a reforming sinner saved only by the grace of God. And there are times when I have not served this organization well in that call to faith. Harsh words that were delivered that shouldn't have been. Things left undone that should have been done. Things done that shouldn't have been done. But all along the way, I've looked at my work for the NAR in response to Christ's call to serve others. A journey this long and this complicated cannot be walked alone. And there are a few people, well, there are hundreds of people, there are thousands of people who have helped me through this work. Time doesn't permit me to name them all, but I have a half a dozen of them that really need special thanks. And I think it's perfectly appropriate for those of you who are here to applaud when appropriate, and I'm sure that you're smart enough to figure out when that is. First and foremost, by far and away, and above all others, an attorney, a fiber artist, the stated clerk of the Presbytery of Chicago, the Reverend Dr. Barbara Mundick, my thanks. Could consider, if you will, the life of the First Lady of the NAR. Compared and contrasted with the life of Laura Bush, the First Lady of the United States.
I got it better.
When George gets ready to go off to a meeting, where does he get to go? He takes Laura to places like London, and Paris, and Tokyo. Barbara Bundick has had her choice of these locations. Kenosha, Wisconsin. Muncie, Indiana. Waco, Texas in August. When Laura needs to go, George calls up Marine One. They fly to the airport to get on Air Force One. Where does Barbara go? She goes to remote parking and gets on Southwest Airlines. When she gets there, Laura Bush gets to go to five-star hotels in all the aforementioned cities. Dr. Bundick goes to Ramada. Through all these indignities and more, Barbara has suffered, has maintained her good sense of humor. She and I have built not one, but two houses, raised our children, gone through seminary, buried her mother. She's become fast friends to many of you and has sincerely enjoyed her time in the NAR. Don't think she wouldn't have expected to otherwise. And I love and cherish her more for sharing my journey. To my teacher, my mentor, and my friend for the past three decades, a wily politician, a devil in disguise, the NAR's sixth president, J. Patrick Miller, my thanks. It was 1977. The NAR board gathered at the Pittsburgh Spring Convention for a meeting. I was surprised upon my arrival to hear that that crazy man who wrote all these articles for Model Rocketry magazine, or Model Rocketeer magazine, that involved math I had no hope of understanding, and wondering why we were printing those, was going to show up, my colleague, Pat Miller. Something strange happened at this convention. Pat and I had a conversation, and it began a fast friendship of 30 years. I found that he and I had many of the same ideas about how the NAR ought to be run, and what needed to be done, and our willingness to work together to make the NAR a better place. When Pat was NAR president, he would sometimes make decisions I did not understand. Now I understand why he made them, because I have his perspective. He was a wily politician. He was quite concerned about my being NAR president because I don't like to play politics. And he said to me, "Bunny, if you don't play politics, they will play you." After I've been NAR president 4 or 5 years, he would often call up. We would chat for an hour or so. He would ask me about politics in the NAR. I would tell him what I was doing with those politics and how I was handling them. And then he would have a hearty laugh and say, "You are one devious SOB." I knew then that he had taught me those lessons, and I had learned them, and I had learned them to good effect. I was quite concerned when Pat stopped being president that he might not be able to do that. I was worried that he would meddle. One time, not long into my presidency, he called me up to ask about a particular matter. I described to him what I was going to do about it, why I thought that was a good thing to do. There was the proverbial pregnant pause on the other end of the line, and he said, "Okay," and our conversation ended. 2 months later, I called him about some other matter, and when he answered the phone, he said, "Mr. President, how are you?" It was the highest compliment he could have paid me. For I knew then that he had given up. He was confident in my leadership and willing to let me lead. And Pat, if you were here tonight, I tell you, now I'm going to go learn this lesson too. To a fierce NAR competitor, a man of technical skill unparalleled in the NAR, an officer and a gentleman in the finest sense of the word, the NAR Vice President, Tripp Barber, my thanks. They were the closest thing to celebrities that were on NAR competition ranges on the East Coast when I was a young competitor, the members of the MIT Rocket Society. They would show up at the Mars Regional in the fall and the Ekron Regional in the spring. They would unload the Volvo station wagon with boxes of models and outrageous claims of performance. They didn't always win, but they sure scared the hell out of everybody they were flying against. Long hair and tie-dye t-shirts, they were the closest thing to a counterculture group that a geeky hobby could have, all except one guy. A crew cut and khakis. I wondered first why he was hanging out with them, and then realized that he enjoyed nothing more than cutting the heart out of his fellow competitors and eating them on the field. Over the years, I came to appreciate his technical skill and his ability to crystallize problems and deliver solutions in a way that, you know, I simply could not comprehend. It was a skill I always envied. At one point, we had a particularly thorny problem in an NAR board meeting. I sat around for 20 minutes listening to the NAR board try to sort this all out. Turned to my right, expecting the standard answer to pop out of Tripp's brain. And I knew we were going to be in for a little overtime when, paraphrasing for polite company here tonight, he looked at me and said, "Bunny, this is really fouled up." It was the only time that he failed me. An NAR's president's weapons inventory is naturally limited, and there aren't very many weapons that are fire and forget. But the six most comforting words I ever heard come across a phone line when I talked to Tripp was, "Okay, I'll take care of it." He and I have shared many of the NAR's triumphs, and our own personal lives have become intertwined. And I respect him more than anybody in the NAR, and would it to hang in the balance, I would trust Tripp with my life. To America's Renaissance rocketeer, a man of immense wit, a very sharp photographic eye, and an excellent editor, Sport Rocketry editor Tom Beach, my thanks. I was new to the Midwest. I was trying to get club newsletters, and what came out of Minnesota but a mimeographed thing that reminded me of the spotter letter newsletter that I'd read on the East Coast. The plans were interesting, the articles were amusing, the comics outrageous. I must meet these people. We would fly together at local contests up in Wisconsin, and the creativity, the energy, and the passion for our hobby were evident even back in the 1970s. And when it was within my power to do so, there was no question that Tom would edit the magazine. Tom was one of maybe three or four people who had an unlimited call option of my time when I was an NAR president. I would do anything for him. And his task was simple and complicated all in the same breath. I told him when I met him, Sport Rocketry editor, all you have to do is go get contact, and that is awfully hard. He's worked diligently, creatively, and consistently to deliver that to you. And every 2 months, I knew that I could count on something interesting showing up in my mailbox, and regardless of what condition the NAR is and how badly other projects might go, he would remind me about why I love and cherish this hobby. The closest thing the NAR has to a humorist. A man for whom the phrase "still waters run deep" probably was written, the NAR Prime Minister, Rick Gaff, my teammate, my thanks. It was another story of me being new to the Midwest. I was the chairman of the contest bar, a perfectly unenviable position. I had a rules decision to make, and I needed some advice. I called everybody I knew back on the East Coast, and nobody was home. So I took a flyer on the then Midwest Contest Board chairman, this guy named Rick Gaff, whom I'd met a couple of times. After a 30-minute phone call, when I hung up, I went, "Oh my God, I've screwed up. I have underestimated this man and his capabilities." He understood the issue, he understood the subtleties, he had some good advice for me. And I said, "I won't make this mistake again." Since that night, Rick Gaff and I have run together to NARAMS, suffered through all kinds of contest-related disasters of our own making and of others, and become fast friends. His judgment is really so sound that it defies description. And those of you who don't know Rick well need to get to know him better. Because of the soundness of his judgment, for the past 14 years, every time I needed to make a major decision about the NAR, I always consulted Rick. And now that my time as president is over, I'm looking forward to doing what we always enjoy, getting in a car, driving somewhere to a rocket launch, flying a rocket, having a few laughs, and seeing old friends. Last but certainly not least, to a fellow citizen who grew up south of the Mason-Dixon line, a man with a sharp pencil but a very big heart, the NAR treasurer, Stu McNabb, my thanks. It was gray, it was cold, it was raining and snowing in Cincinnati, Ohio. Pat Miller called the NAR board together to discuss the principal millstone around our necks, Fort Rock Tree Magazine. Much to my shock, the NAR comptroller, not a member of the NAR board, Stu McNabb, had showed up. When it came time during the portion of the meeting to go over financials, particularly the Fort Rock Tree financials, Stuart began to speak. After about 5 minutes, I looked up to the ceiling, and I offered a silent prayer. "Dear God, thank you. There's somebody else in the room who speaks accounting." Accounting is a language. It tells a story. It's not necessarily complicated, but most people don't know the language and they're afraid of it. Stuart understood it. He was capable of explaining it to a bunch of technical people who didn't really want to learn accounting. But it was so important. The story that it tells is the financial solvency and capability of your organization. And unless you know it, you cannot make good decisions. And it was very important that we got it right, and Stuart did, and continues to do that. Over time, though, it turned out that he had an interest in other NAR subjects. He had an interest in education because he understood, as a poor boy from the country, like your president, that education was important to improving one's life. And he took this on as his second mission. And he believes very deeply and he's very committed to it. And I think Stuart's work for the NAR is unfinished. While he continues to provide that support for our financial safety and security, I think he has much more to offer to education. And I pray and hope that he'll get a chance to do that for us. Love the future. Well, my crystal ball is cloudy and cracked, so I won't make any predictions. But I do have some messages. I have a message first for the new president. First, seize the bully pulpit. NAR members want to hear from you, and you need to communicate to them. They will think some of what you say to them is weird. They will reject some of it. They will accept others of it. They will engage you in dialogue. It's important that you communicate, and it's important that you be as clear as you can, because Pat Miller warned me that not everybody is listening, and the message doesn't always get through the first time. So keep communicating. Seize that pulpit. Second, set a direction. Your direction. The one thing only the president can do is set the direction. Be guided but not bound by the past. Whatever I have done has brought us here. Whatever you do going forward will take us wherever we need to go. Set the direction. And lastly, cherish your time. It will go by faster than you think. You are now the big fish in an admittedly small pond, but there are wonderful and amazing things that NAR members have and NAR members do, and go and enjoy them because the field is rich with harvest. I have a message for my colleagues on the NAR board. First, remember that the job you have is a sacred trust. The members believe, they believed you when you said you could do something and you were willing to do the work. Don't forget that trust you have with the members. Second of all, support your president. And by that I do not mean to rubber stamp him. Challenge him as you've challenged me. Work with him, engage him with dialogue. Tell him about things going on because he does need to hear them. And if you do those things, then you will have provided the support that he needs to do his job in the same way you supported me. Lastly, cherish and support one another. And by that, I mean to do what you've done for me, which is to go into NAR board meetings, have differences, have dialogue, have debates, argue with one another, sort it all out, and go to dinner afterwards. Lastly, I have a message for all of you, NAR members. First of all, protect our safety record. I can say it over and over again. We can write articles, we can communicate it, but unless you actually do it, it won't work. And on this, all depends. If we ever, ever, ever have a serious safety problem, the entire hobby, both what belongs to the NAR and belongs to others, is at risk. Please, please protect our safety record. Second of all, support your president. He's trying to lead you. Engage him in dialogue and get involved. When he, the board, or an NAR committee says they need your help, they do really mean it. There are lots of ways for you to get involved that don't involve any risk to you. It's a lot easier than you think, and you'll make the NAR a better place than it is now. Get involved with them. And lastly, respect one another. There's an important former bumper sticker that Century Engineering put out that said, "My rock tree, America's 87th most popular hobby." I think that number's wrong, and it's not to the high side. Because we're such a small community, if we argue and bicker with one another, particularly in forums and on the internet, that does not help the hobby. The hobby's quite diverse. When I went to the ORR this weekend and I asked for a picture of NARM contest directors, I looked at the assembled multitude as board pool was lining us all up and thought, all of these people have the same job and the same challenges. And they are different as night and day, one from another, as any group that's here tonight. If that can be our hobby, and we can overcome those differences and still have fun at NARMs, then we can do that more broadly. And we should love and cherish one another because, you know, someday we might actually be America's 87th most popular hobby if we do that. My time with you is over. I've had a great time, and I leave you as I came.
in the company of good friends, surrounded by good models, and enrolled with God's peace. Thank you all. Mr. Secretary, do you have the results of the election?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure that the results were ever in doubt. John Hochheimer received 153 votes. Joyce Guzik, 161. And Stuart McNabb, 158. And they are your reelected board members. Sir, are there any other business to be brought?
I want orders from somebody.
Oh. Not a good thing.
You heard the cackle, so you should know who it is.
Uh-oh.
I was asked to make this presentation from the NAR Widows. Literally, a little token of their appreciation.
That's cute.
It's a little glass bunny. This is your retirement present, I think.
Awesome. No gold.
We actually have a place for these in our home, don't we, dear?
We do.
If there is no other business, yes?
Move that the organization recognize the achievements of Mark Bundick and thank him for his service.
Second.
Who seconded?
Clint Thomas, Indianapolis.
This is crazy. All of us. Opposed by the same side. The chair declares the motion is passed. If there's no other business, the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Okay, all those in favor, please rise. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
I'm not sure how that works. Maybe that's what they do with the voting at the end of it. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the officers are elected from a vote.
Oh, they are.
That's what we check.
It's not too often, but I'm not sure.
Oh, anyway, I get it.